are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
And welcome to No Chefs Allowed. I am Megan O'Connor, and I am in my kitchen, actually with some bacon in a skillet right now in my kitchen in Chicago, Illinois. And as always, on Monday night, I get to cook with my sister. Hey, Trisha.
Hey, Megan, what's up?
Besides a little bacon in a skillet.
Yeah, you didn't mention bacon before. I thought you were just making chicken, but now your dish sounds wonderful.
I am doing a braised chicken breast. Sort of. That's what the recipe's called, but whatever.
Sort
parts
of.
Is it's parts. Called braised. Parts is parts. I don't have all the right parts of the chicken, but that's okay. So I'm going to be braising my chicken, and I'm starting with some bacon in a skillet to create some fabulous bacon grease, which one has to have when making anything delicious, frankly.
Right.
But
right.
Also, I'm going to eat, what?
Are you bone in or bone out on the chicken? I'm curious now exactly what you're doing.
Well, see, the recipe called for bone-in chicken breasts, but my husband doesn't like bone-in chicken. Like, he gets weird about it. Like, won't eat it, in fact. It's just ridiculous. But it's the truth. It's just the truth. So,
right.
But I, on the other hand, I'm fine with the bone. I think it's great. So I ended up buying, instead of four bone-in skin on chicken breast, as per the recipe, I bought two boneless, skinless chicken breasts, and then some legs and thighs, skin on.
Yeah.
So I'm doing a little combination.
I like that. Mix it up.
Mix it up. Make everybody chicken happy. Speaking of chickens, before we get to what our theme of the show is today, I think everybody know that last week, in a surprise move by Trisha's husband, Christopher Gills, Trisha was granted permission to get a chicken coop and three chickens for her backyard.
Three chickens. It was a huge feat for us. I mean, Adam and I, we talked in the morning because it was my birthday, and I looked him in the eye and I said, if we are ever going to get permission, today is the day. That we have to do it today. We have to ask, whatever. And the funniest part of the whole thing, so he says, yes, we can go get chickens. We're responsible for the chickens, like, it's our project, that kind of thing. So, but before he gives us permission, we're talking back and forth, and he says, you know, well, how long do they live? I'm like, well, I'm not exactly sure yet. And he's like, what are you going to do at the end? And I was like, well, we'll just slaughter them and eat them. And he's like, you're going to slaughter the chickens that you raise. And I was like, well, yeah. And I turn around, and Adam, who's 9, and our 4-year-old daughter have the biggest tears in their eyes. And Margo looks up, and she goes, we're going to kill a chicken. I turn right back around to Chris, and I go, we're not gonna slaughter them. We're just going to eat their eggs. And we all moved on. They stopped crying, and I was like, note to self, we will not be slaughtering our chickens. Which is fine. I'm not sure how we're going to broach that when it comes to it. But
well, no, you just do what every parent does when they get rid of a pet. They say, oh, we're taking it to the farm. It needed a better place to live. And then you go, then you have chicken for dinner. They won't know. They won't.
Oh, I could never do that. I could never do that to them. But I did think we could have chicken for dinner, but just not that chicken. But anyway, so we are on.
Or you could do what we do around here when an animal dies.
Don't even say it on the show.
Okay, sorry. I'm done. All right.
Audience, you do not want to know what she did. Anyway, so we're getting chickens over here. It's our summer project, and we're super excited about it. Thank you for bringing that up. Now I'm all excited.
Well,
So then we have to break the other news about the show today, right?
What is it?
It's our series finale.
Oh, it is our series finale, folks. No Chefs Allowed, weekly Monday night cooking together program is coming to an end today.
But we have met, over the last year, we have met some wonderful, awesome foodies that I cannot be happier about being able to meet and talk to once a week. and cook with you. And so today's grand finale, series finale show, we are toasting with Virtue Cider Hard Apple Cider. So we figured we needed a celebratory subject for the series finale. So yep. Megan's cooking, but I got my feet up. You know, it's been a year of cooking.
Every Monday. Yeah.
Half an hour right now. So I'm excited to talk with Greg Hall, the founder of Virtue Cider, and have him walk me through these. I have to admit, he sent us some so we could try them, and I have to admit, I already drank one.
And it was worth it. What?
It was worth it.
It was? Which one did you have? So he sent us three. Well, we should talk through these with him, but he did send us three different bottles with three different varieties, I guess. And we'll have him talk through all these different varieties and why. But I love the way the bottle looks first. I haven't cracked mine open yet, but I'm going to ask Greg what I should put into my braised chicken.
Awesome. They will be good to cook with, for sure. I tried the Mitten. It's called the Mitten, and it's bourbon barrel aged cider. And you will all want to make a run to your local liquor store and pick it up.
That's right. And it's called the Mitten because Virtue Cider is gets their apples from Michigan.
Yes.
All of you know what the shape of Michigan looks like. There you have it, people.
See, it's not just cooking. It's geography, too.
There's so much to offer. At least we did. Oh, just kidding.
Yeah,
folks, we are going to continue our show. We're just going to be coming back with a little different format and some different things. So anyway, having said that, let's take a quick break, Tricia. I'm going to get this bacon out of this pot.
I've been
pot.
Breaking since we started.
I know. I'm busy cooking dinner for my family, and you got your feet up. But let's take a quick break, and let's bring Greg Hall from Virtue Cider on, and let's talk to him about what's happening.
Sounds
all right?
Good.
So folks, we'll be right back in just a minute with No Chefs Allowed. Welcome back, everybody, to No Chefs Allowed. I'm Megan O'Connor in my kitchen in Chicago. And as always, I'm cooking with my sister, Tricia, who's in her kitchen, not cooking, just drinking, in Columbus, Ohio. How are you doing, Tricia?
I'm good. I got my feet up. Nobody's in my house right now. And I've got a couple bottles of hard apple cider to open to celebrate our series finale. So I'm really good.
Good. Well, we don't really want you to be drinking alone. That's why I'm here, and our special guest, Greg Hall, the owner, founder, man about town for Virtue Cider. Greg, are you there?
I'm here. Hi, Megan. Hi, Tricia.
Hello.
Welcome, Greg.
Thanks very much for inviting me in tonight.
Of course. You're invited every night, just so you know. So don't just think it needs to be Mondays at 4.
Just bring the cider and you're invited.
You bring the bacon and I'll bring the cider.
Okay, perfect. Got it. Oh.
So, Greg, why don't you tell us how Virtue Cider got started?
Sure. I've been a fan of cider for many years. I started actually in the brewing world. My father opened Goose Island in 1988, and I started working there right away as an assistant in the brewery. And then I went through Siebel, and over time became the head guy there on the brewing side. And in the early days, that was all at our brew pub on Clybourne in Chicago, and we would have some guest beers, and we also had some guest cider. I always liked the idea of cider. And we would usually have woodchuck on, because that was really just about the only thing we could find. And, it was, I think people were happy with it. I was pretty happy with it, but I kind of felt like maybe cider didn't have quite the breadth of possibilities that beer did or wine did, because I would kind of only have just a couple ciders. That was all that was available to me. And then in 2000, I took a group of Goose Island brewers over to England to visit breweries, and that was great. I could do a whole show on visiting breweries in England, but since we're talking about cider, I'll tell you that we wandered into a pub up in the city of York called the Maltings, which I would highly recommend if you're ever in the city of York.
I have been there, but I don't remember
They were having a cider festival, so they had about 40 ciders from around the country, all farmhouse ciders. So we said, hey, let's try some cider. And there were seven of us, so we ordered seven different ciders and passed them around, tasted them. We're like, holy cow, these are phenomenal ciders, and they're all completely different. You know, we kind of expected them to be fairly similar, but some that were really dry and full of tannin, and some that were lower in tannin, some that were really high acid, some that were sweet and murky, some that were crystal clear. But the exciting thing was that they were all completely different. So we said, okay, let's order seven more. And then we had seven more.
And then we
actually came back the next night to finish off the list. So we tried all 40 ciders over two nights.
Wow.
And we came back to the States and we're super pumped about English beer, but we're also pumped about cider. And I talked to my father and I said, wouldn't it be great if we were the first craft brewer to start making cider? And he said, yeah, it's a great idea. I'll put it on the list of your far too many ideas, Greg, and maybe we'll get to it someday, but not right now. And we just never got to it. We talked about it a couple other times. We never got to it at Goose Island. So in 2011, I left Goose Island, and I knew exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to make cider. And in the interim, I'd been studying up a little bit more on English and French cider and trying the North American ciders that were available, which still weren't too many, and thought, boy, there's a whole world out there that people in the U.S. don't know about. Pretty similar to the beer world back in the 80s. You know, when we opened Goose Island, people thought there were three kinds of beer, light beer, dark beer, and import beer, you know, that you were lucky enough to drink at weddings. And that was about it. And when we opened Goose Island, you know, we had porter and a stout on tap, and people are like, "Why do you have two dark beers? That's crazy. You know, you don't need two." And you know, that's kind of the way it was back then. And you know, I think people just a couple years ago kind of had that same feeling about cider. Mike Roper at the Hop Leaf in Chicago, one of the best beer bars on the planet. Never had a cider on tap. And he said people would come to the bar and they would order, you know, very specific beers. They'd say, give me, a Zombie Dust, and give me an Allagash White, and give me a Goose Island Matilda. But then they would say, and give me a cider. They would not be specific with cider because everybody thought all ciders were alike.
Right.
And then... now I think you're seeing there's a little bit of a renaissance in cider in America, and we're trying to make some real traditional European style farmhouse ciders, and there's other people doing all sorts of fun things. So a lot of great American cider makers. Some guys are doing flavored ciders, you know, and those are popular too. But we're kind of sticking to that real traditional European farmhouse style.
So how would you describe, someone who didn't know what the difference was, how do you describe the farmhouse style cider?
Well, you know, when I went over, when I left Goose and I took the summer in 2011 and spent a lot of it in England and France visiting cider makers. And one thing I found right away is cider is super agricultural. Most of these guys are farmers first, and they're multi-generational farmers. Five, seven, even 10 generations of in the same family, and they've been growing apples this whole time.
Like beer,
much more, I think, like kind of the European wine tradition. Although there's certainly some brewers that have been like that in Belgium as well. Sadly, some of them are falling off. I knew the Fullers, I knew some of the people at Young's, and there's still some family breweries over there that are multi-generational, but not as much as there used to be. But cider is typically multi-generational, made on the farm, and made with apples, and that's really it. Most of the producers have been doing it the same way for generations, far before they had an understanding of cultured yeast. So they basically just press the apples and then wait for it to ferment without adding anything. And because cider making, like winemaking, is a process really free of heat, you don't really boil the juice like you do in brewing, as you boil the wort. So you never really sanitize it. The microflora that comes in on the fruit is what ferments the cider. So it's a supernatural process. It's a process you have to be very patient with, because you have to wait till the apples are ready, and then you get your one shot to make your cider. And then you have to wait. And one of the cider makers in England, I was asking them, they don't have any glycol, they don't have any temperature control on their tanks. How long does it take to ferment? And he said, well, if we press in September, it could be 3 or 4 weeks. If we press in November, it's a cold winter, it could be 4 or 5 months till it's ready.
Wow,
and that's
so
just
you really
the way
have to be watching
they've always
it at
done
all
it.
Time.
So, yeah, it's pretty interesting. And as a brewer, I went in there with a long list of questions about quality control and yeast counts and pH and oxidation, and nobody could answer anything. They don't really worry about that kind of stuff. From a brewer's perspective, I would say if you were a brewer, you'd be pretty careless. But as a cider maker, that's just the way they do it. And their ciders turned out fantastic. And a lot of that has to do with as it ferments out and finishes, they don't really serve it straight. They always blend. And that's part of the mastery of being a cider maker. Again, a little bit more like being a winemaker. You're not really making a batch of cider as is usually. You're making component ciders that you blend into your final cider.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
So how do you control not having it not turn into apple cider vinegar?
Acetobacter is what's going to make it vinegar, and that's airborne. So typically what you do is you ferment and keep your cider in a nice sealed vessel. We've got some stainless steel tanks. We've got 20 of them, or 2,000 gallons, so we ferment everything in those tanks. And then we'll transfer either to barrels, or then we've got some poly tanks that we store it in the cider as well. But you want to keep the air out. And I think the one culture where that's not quite as important is in Spain, where you definitely have some both lactic and acetic characters to the cider. And I think that's just because their history of making cider is even older than the French and the English. They've been doing that way for at least 2,000 years. And some of the cider is pretty rough, but I think it's super interesting and kind of full of intrigue, because there's stuff in there that any I think winemaker or most brewers would say would be a fault. But it's what everybody drinks in Spain. So it's kind of like, it's the cheese that's moldy and that mold is blue because you inject it. Maybe it's a fault unless you want it there, then it's no longer a fault.
Right.
It's just part of the character of the product.
I'm going to use that with some of my meals.
It's just the character of your meal.
Right. The character of this meal. This is not a fault. This is just how I like it. It's how, yeah. I love that. I mean,
that's a really good call.
I am like cider.
So, at Virtue Cider, Greg, you're making everything from scratch, right? Like, you own the orchard?
Well, we when we bought our farm about 2 years ago, we bought a farm that had been an orchard in the past for several generations. The Morse family had it from the 1800s all the way up to about 2000, and then they sold it, and a developer bought it, and he unfortunately knocked down almost all the apple trees because he wanted to put a subdivision on this beautiful land.
The recession.
Fortunately for us, the economy tanked, and he did not get his funding to put in a subdivision. So we bought the farm in its old state with the old original farmhouse from the 1880s, but most of the apple trees were gone. So we've replanted some trees, but it's our intent not just to grow our own fruit, but to buy fruit from our neighbors, because we're in an area they call the Fruit Belt in Southwest Michigan, where there is quite a bit of apples, peaches, blueberries, blackberries, raspberries grown. It's a great climate for growing fruit. And that's one of the other things I learned when I went to Europe, is most of the places with great cider traditions, if you look at Ireland or the southwest of England or Brittany and Normandy and France, or the Asturias region or Basque region in Spain, they're all coastal. They're all right on the coast, and they all get a lot of rain. They get about 40 inches of rain a year. It's a nice rainy day in Chicago right now, so the trees will love that. And in western Michigan, we also get about 40 inches of rain a year. So we actually get the same amount of rain that they get in those great cider-producing regions, and that's perfect for the trees. So all of our neighbors, not all of our neighbors, but a lot of our neighbors grow apples, and because they've been doing it for many generations, they don't necessarily have the new hot apple varieties.
They've got some really old-world varieties.
And that allows us to make some pretty cool cider.
Well, let's dive into the cider. Let's take a quick break, and then when we come back, why don't you walk us through the ciders that you sent to us and that we're tasting today, and then we can talk about Megan's dish and see what would go best with her chicken. Does that sound good?
Great. Sounds fantastic.
Cool. We will be right back to Toast with Greg Hall here in a minute with some more No Chefs Allowed.
Welcome back, folks, to No Chefs Allowed. I'm Megan O'Connor in my kitchen in Chicago. Trisha is in her kitchen in Columbus, Ohio. And we have with us Greg Hall from Virtue Cider, who has been sharing with us all the kind of ins and outs of hard cider. Thank you so much for that, Greg. And now we want Greg to talk to us about the ciders that we have on our countertop. So.
Great.
You were kind enough to share with us three bottles of Virtue Cider. We have three varieties. We have the Mitten, which Trisha admitted she'd been drinking already. We have Leadberry, which, looks like it maybe has an English appeal. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. And then we have Sidra de Nava, which is a Spanish variety, or comes to us with the taste of Spain that you tasted in your travels. So we want to taste some. Well, Trisha's already tasted.
So it's a nice selection. It's three completely different ciders that kind of come from three different cultures, really. And I think probably the best one to start with is the Ledbury, because that's the one that has probably the most familiar cidery flavors. That is an English medium cider. If you go to the farmhouse cider makers in the southwest of England, in the counties of Somerset and Devon and Herefordshire, Worcestershire, Dorset, they all make cider right on the farm, and they typically will offer three varieties: dry, medium, and sweet. And those will be, so that's usually what a cider maker will have, those three. The dry will be the one that when they fermented it, dried out all the way and tastes great just the way it is. The medium will typically be not fermented out quite all the way and maybe have a little more body and a little more character. And that will be determined mostly by the apples that are in there. And then third will be the sweet. And the sweet is usually a batch of dry that maybe didn't taste quite as good as the other dry, but then will back sweeten with either fresh juice or sometimes even sugar. So it has some nice sweetness to balance out all the fruit in there. So the one that a lot of cider makers are most proud of is the medium, because it's kind of in between. It's got some good character in it, and typically, as I was saying before, they ferment stuff out with the yeast that comes straight from the orchard. So that's what we did. We bought primarily bittersweet apples for this, and that's what you'd be using to make your cider in England. Apples come in really something like 13,000 named varieties, but mm-hmm. broadly you can break it into four categories. Sweet apples, which are the type of apples we're most familiar with in the U.S., you find at the store, that are low in acidity and low in tannin. And then there's tart apples. Those are varieties like Granny Smith or Golden Delicious are the ones you know the best. They're more high acid, but also low tannin. And then you've got varieties that are high tannin and low acid. Those are bittersweet. And then high acid and high tannin, and those are bitter sharp. You don't find too many of those. And you never find bitter sharps or bitter sweets at the grocery store because they're, frankly, too bitter to eat. And if you've ever had the great pleasure of biting into a crab apple,
yeah,
you probably know what a bitter sweet
like a crab apple.
Yeah. So they're really good for making cider, but not so good for eating. So we use probably about 20 different varieties of bitter sweets in there, press them, and then just let it ferment out all by itself. So the yeast that comes straight from the orchard, and it's a little bit on our farm, on our equipment, will be what ferments it out. And very soon there'll be enough alcohol in there that will kill off any microflora, most of the microflora. But the yeast will keep fermenting and keep chugging along. So that's a cider where the apples were pressed in October, and we let that ferment all the way until the end of February when it was done fermenting, and then gave it a little bit of condition time, and then put it in the package. So we think of it as a very traditional English-style medium cider, and we named it for the town of Ledbury. Mm-hmm. Ledbury is a town in Herefordshire, and I first went to Herefordshire actually when I was a brewer to buy hops, and we bought a bunch of English Fuggles over there. And then I went back to Ledbury to meet, Fuggles.
What's a Fuggle?
Fuggle is a English hop, one of the parents of the American hop, the Willamette. And it's also thought to be a descendant of the Steering Golding hop. And at Coos Island, we use a lot of Steering Goldings. And then one year, they had really bad weather in Slovenia where we got the Styrians, and we couldn't get as many Styrians as we wanted. So we kind of bulked up on Fuggles. And production manager and I.
There's a whole vocabulary out there that I've never heard before.
So hop variety is, of course, very important to making beer, and then and cider making, it's the apple variety. Because
so
we get everything.
Did you open your Leadbury?
I did. I already opened
it. Okay, so tell us about it.
So you called this a medium. Like, it is. This one to me has more of a wine taste to it than the one that I tried earlier, the Mitten. Am I right, or am I? I always feel.
I think what it shares with some wines is being, all natural fermentation.
Mm-hmm.
So yeast that's in there is a potpourri of different yeasts, different microflora, whatever they have in their orchard. The beer that we drink today is fermented with pure culture yeast. So hundreds of billions of times. That's what most of the beer you find in the market. I have all the reason for it. Like or a natural wine, it's a huge different microflora, and I think that gives you a little bit more complexity that you might associate with wine. So it has there's really no way for us to identify all the yeast that are in there, because some of them die off pretty early in the process, but they do contribute to the flavor.
That's cool. I really like it. It's not as sweet as I thought it would be. Like, maybe because normal ciders that I've had are like the woodchuck, where there's just a little bit of sweetness going on there. But this is really lovely.
Thank you. Maybe not this generation, but for many generations before, Europeans kind of thought of American beer as all being kind of one type, and not being super heavy on flavor and character. And, I think that was probably pretty accurate. I think it was better a little bit, too.
Well, let's move on to go ahead.
I was just going to say, when you look at English cider, it typically is a little drier and has some good tannin in it. And I think that's what you'll find. Anytime you're tasting cider, I think you're always going to get some fruit up front, and then kind of some secondary flavors, and then it's that mix of sugar, acid, and tannin that really drives the flavor profile. And most of the big ciders, you're not going to get much acid, and you're not going to get much tannin. It's going to be all sugar. And for English ciders, typically you really lead with the tannin.
Yeah, I like it. So. How would you describe, if you describe this as a medium, how would you describe this Sidra de Nava, which is the Spanish influenced one?
Sure. So in Spain, they do things a little differently. Number one, they don't use fruit with quite as much tannin. They use
they run
high acid fruit
in the middle of the street, which is another thing they do differently than us. Just saying.
Absolutely. Right. Their cider making culture is really based in the north. Of course, the great winemakers throughout most of the country, but in the north, it might be a little too cool for them to be as successful with the grape. So they grow. They've been growing cider apples, for over 2,000 years in the north of Spain, and they make a very rustic style of cider. They call it natural cider. Where they basically just take the apples, press them, and let it ferment out. And because they're high acid to begin with, the ciders typically are more sharp. But then they also kind of go through a process where you convert the acidity from, they go through malolactic fermentation. So they go from malic acid, which is in the apple, to lactic acid, which starts to soften it up. But then with the introduction of a little bit of air, they get a little bit of acetic acid going on there too. So I think on the nose you get almost a lemony type aroma.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the it's a very thin body. It's fermented all the way dry, and
it's
then you
really
definitely
dry.
Get a good amount of acid.
I love it, but I'm a dry. I go into the wine store and say, sell me whatever is lip smacking dry.
Because I love a dry white wine, and this, I love this for the same reason. I love that.
Yeah, you know,
really dry
in the beer world, it seems like. In the beer world, it seems like sour beers are becoming more popular every day, and you know, sour ciders have been around even longer than sour beers. So, but a lot of people aren't used to them. So when we do festivals, we ask people who like sour beer, and when they try the Cedar de Nava, they get pretty excited.
Yeah. So real quick, I know we're running out of time. It's been so fun. You're obviously so passionate about what you're doing, and I feel like we could talk for hours on how you do what you do. But lucky for me, I just get to taste it. But one of the things you said on the break, so I'm making this braised chicken, and I was asking Greg which of these ciders I should put in my chicken, and he suggested the Cedar de Nava, the Spanish one. And tell us a little bit about why, because I thought that was pretty interesting.
Sure, absolutely. Well, you know, in northern Spain, they cook primarily with cider instead of with beer or wine, and it's in so many dishes. They have more cider per capita than anywhere in the world in northern Spain, and it's so much a part of their culture, and it has a lot of acidity to it, and I think that acidity will bring out some interesting flavors in the dish and then also add some flavors as well. Some of the chefs in Chicago that I worked with when we were doing stuff at Goose Island, they would say, you know, we love your beers, but you know, they sometimes overpower our food. We'd like stuff with more acid and less bitterness.
Mm.
And that's when we really started promoting beers like Matilda and Sophie at Goose, and found those worked so well with food because they had the attributes that the chefs were looking for, a little more acidity. So when it came to the cider world, it was a very natural progression to both cook with cider and pair it with food. Because that acidity is such a nice contrast to the richness, for instance, the bacon that you're using in your dish, and just any protein. So I think acid always goes with protein.
Yeah, so I'm putting it in. This recipe calls for, it's making me a little sad to put this much in my dish, 2 cups.
Just use one and
just
drink the rest.
Yeah, maybe start there and drink the rest.
It's going to be the best chicken you ever had, but only use one.
Well, Greg, thank you so much. This has been really fun. So where can we get your cider? I know in Chicago, give us a few spots, favorite spots where we could, our listeners could go pick up some of your cider and do their own tasting.
Sure, absolutely. We're in a lot of bars and restaurants. All over town, like I said, Hopleaf, Publicans usually got us on. I was in there for brunch, and they were pouring the Ledbury. In the off-premise, we have our ciders in most Whole Foods. We're now in Trader Joe's as well, so if you get a Trader Joe's around the corner, it'd be a good place to pick up the Ledbury.
Okay.
And then Binny's, of course, carries just about all our ciders. And then if I can also talk to one of my favorite independents, West Lakeview Liquors, right up the street.
Oh, I know where that is. Yep. Of course, Megan knows where that is.
They not only have a great beer store, but they've got, along with Benny's, probably the broadest selection of ciders in this area.
But you're going coastal,
states,
right? Like you're going. I thought I read somewhere you're going out to Washington. Your stuff's going to be available out in Washington. Is that right?
Yeah, we're in Washington, Oregon, and California on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And then right now we're in pretty much all the Great Lakes states, Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Ohio. Down in Kentucky, we trade them some cider for bourbon barrels.
Perfect.
And then just started shipping. We're in New York and Pennsylvania on the East Coast, and New Jersey, Connecticut, and just started shipping to Florida as well. So we're adding,
for Ohio?
States,
he said Ohio. Oh, he did?
Oh, yeah, we're in Ohio. Ohio is one of our first states. We're statewide with the great folks at Cavalier. So they've got warehouses in Cleveland, Columbus, and Cincinnati. So they've got the 3 C's. We're pretty well covered. And they're doing
great. All right, Trisha's
going to
go on the hunt.
Job.
Look out, Greg. She's going to be out there. That's what you do. So. Go around, Trisha, and ask everybody for it, and then they'll all be starting to talk about it. You know, Columbus. Next thing you know, be everywhere.
Sounds good.
That's a great plan.
Well, thank you so much. You know, last thing, Greg, I was telling some folks at your office that I really want to come to the orchard sometime. So I might be knocking on the door for a little private tasting this summer.
Yeah, that would be fantastic. We open in Sunville May 1st. We do tours of the cider house, tastings of all our cider. We usually have about 10 ciders up there. So we've got some small batch stuff that we only sell at the cider house. And it's a pretty neat place. It's right across the street from Fenn Valley, which is one of the oldest wineries in Michigan. Mm-hmm. And then Freddie Biltman, who runs New Holland, lives right across the street there. So it's a pretty good corner.
All right. Trisha, you coming up? Let's go.
I'll meet you there for sure.
All right, good. Well, Greg, thank you so much. It's been great talking to you. Your cider is delicious and lovely, as Trisha said. So, folks, if you've not tried Virtue Cider, get out there and give it a try. I think you will be surprised at what you taste. So wish me luck on my chicken, Greg.
Good luck, Megan. Thanks very much. Thanks for getting me on that last show. Hopefully we'll see you again soon.
Yes,
and,
we're toasting to you.
Let's get a cider next time.
Don't worry, we'll be back. Just not sure exactly how or when, but we'll be back. All right. Thanks,
great.
Greg.
Thanks,
we'll talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
All right, Trisha, this is really tasty stuff.
It's actually just opens up a whole different flavor. It's almost like the preserved lemons. Like, that was just a flavor I had never experienced before, and I love it. And that's what these ciders taste like to me, because they aren't, like, when I think of cider, I think of something kind of sweet, and you can almost only have one. Maybe two.
That's right. In fact, I tried to have a snake bite the other night, you know, which is harp and cider at a bar, and I had one, and it was really good, and then I made a mistake of ordering a second, and as soon as I took a sip of the second one, I was like, ugh, done. I can't drink this.
Right. But this isn't, I mean, the Leadberry was, shockingly dry, because I just wasn't expecting it, and the mint one is a little bit sweeter, but it has that the mitten is aged in a bourbon barrel, and it has that that bourbon smell even more than the taste of it. Like, is that hint of bourbon that I loved. But I would say out of all three of these, the mitten, the one I already consumed, was the sweetest out of all of them, and even that wasn't as sweet as what I think of when I think of a hard cider. So I'm really excited that we were introduced to him, and now I have a new flavor in my kitchen.
I know, and I was thinking about your backyard restaurant, how fabulous it would be to have cider, because this tastes so fresh and crisp and summery to me. Not to say you couldn't drink it in the winter in a dark pub. I get that, too, but maybe it's because I'm just pining for a real spring and summer to happen. But I just want a big, tall glass with those big ice cubes out of the ice cube tray, since we don't have an ice maker, and just pouring that crispy dry cider over those ice cubes. I'm looking forward to that. Pour a little bit of this in my chicken, and then I'll pour myself a nice glass.
And Megan, I would like to say that this has been a fun year with Heritage Radio, and I love how many people we've come across and that we've gotten to meet, the rutabaga curling guy, and we learned how to make preserve lemons, and we talked with Ajumama Korean food truck food, and, you know, and now
we're
excited.
I can't even remember them all. Like, we have to go back. So we cooked with wine, too. We cooked with bourbon this year. We had a lot of, I guess we were drinking on the show.
A lot of
wine on the show, yeah.
Right. But so I'm going to toast you right now, and then we're going to have to sign off as our official last weekly show. And then, ready?
Yep.
Cheers.
Cheered an empty glass with my full glass just for the effect, the radio effect. Did you like that?
Yeah, I liked it a lot. But have a nice evening, and everyone, thanks so much for listening. And we'll be back a little more focused on our monthly ingredient challenge, but don't be a stranger. Visit us on Facebook at No Chefs Allowed and on Twitter. Our handle is at No Chefs Allowed. And we look forward to hearing from you.
Thanks. All right, so Trisha. Talk to you soon.
Sounds great. Bye-bye.
Folks.